Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain. Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice for anyone wanting to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why hospitals in Wisconsin and across the nation could be facing potential fines and penalties.
First, chickens are all the rage in cities these days. Last week, Wisconsin Rapids became the latest city in the state to approve chickens within city limits. When the new ordinance goes in effect, people living in one or two family homes will be able to keep up to four chickens, but cannot keep any roosters.
This latest ordinance is building on a trend around the state and across the country of allowing limited poultry raising within city limits. Larger cities like Madison, Green Bay, and Milwaukee all allow the practice, along with a lot of other smaller cities around the state.
Here to talk about the trend and how those living in cities that allow chickens can get started is Ron Keene. He is the University of Wisconsin Extension poultry specialist. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into how big a trend is it, what's the appeal? Why do so many people want to keep chickens?
Well, that's always a question I get. And I think there are several reasons. I think a lot of it probably is from the local food, know where your food comes from, that type of thing. And so a lot of people get them to produce eggs for their family. I think after they get them especially, and a lot of people find that they really are pretty interesting pets too, and the eggs are maybe a secondary thing. So, but those are usually the reasons I hear.
And you have chickens yourself, right?
I don't have any currently. I, of course, work at the university and we have chickens there on campus, so I get my chicken fix there. and I grew up raising chickens, but I don't currently have any.
What about the eggs? Do they really taste fresher when they come right from the hen in your front yard?
You know, I'll say that I don't notice a whole lot of difference, but I think a lot of it is in the mental aspect of knowing that they are fresh and they are there. So I think a lot of people will tell you that, yes, there's a huge difference.
And we're talking about Wisconsin Rapids being the latest city to allow chicken keeping. How big is this trend in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's somewhat popular. I went about a year ago and had a lot of the county agents send in, and there was at least more than 20 or 25 cities that allow chickens currently. So there's quite a few in the state, and obviously it's still increasing.
Now, how many people do urban chicken keepers, how many chickens, I should say, do people tend to keep in their backyards?
Well, legally four is the limit.
Legally four for everywhere?
Most of them. Most of them. Some will go to five or six, but generally that's the limit. There might be a few that push that limit a little bit, but usually, you know, four hens will produce plenty of eggs for a normal family.
So. Now, chickens have to live outside, and we've had these pretty intense Wisconsin winters. What happens with the chickens in the wintertime?
Yeah, that can be a problem. I would say a lot of the groups in cities where you just have four chickens will provide some heat. Generally, you know, chickens can handle a lot of cold, but just a little bit to take that edge off. Keeping the water thawed, that will help a lot. So a lot of them will heat the water, and that'll provide a little bit of heat for the coop.
Now, not all of Wisconsin allows chickens in urban spaces. What is the kind of argument you might hear against people having chickens in the city?
Sure. I think noise tends to be one concern.
The clucking?
Of course, well, yes, and that's why the roosters aren't allowed generally. Mm-hmm. And even the hens can make some noise, although I think if you compare it to a barking dog, it's pretty minor. Smells would be another concern. And that, I think, becomes an issue, in my experience, for a lot of people if they have had experience on a farm setting where there was, you know, 100 chickens or so. They remember that and the smells and things involved mm-hmm. there. And I think that has been a big issue with people voting against having chickens is that memory of the older farm-style chicken coop.
And what about health concerns? Are there things that people who keep chickens need to be worried about? We know we can get salmonella from eggs. I suppose that's true. Sure. From chickens in your backyard, too.
It is true, yes. And, you know, I think salmonella is probably the most common concern. And really, you can get that from other pets as well. So I always say, you know, wash your hands after handling them. Certainly, the eggs should be handled just like you would handle any other chicken eggs from the store. You know, you usually cook them and clean up after you've handled them. You know, that's probably the most common one. People talk about influenza. Fortunately, the bird flu has not gotten to the U.S., and hopefully it won't, at least the one that is, you know, in the news that causes problems for humans. So probably salmonella is the most common issue.
Now, people who are really into their chickens say that chickens have personalities. And they definitely, if you get into all the breeds, they certainly look different. Some of them are incredible with these ruffly legs. Are you one of those? Do you think these chickens have their own personalities? Chickenalities?
I was going to say, I'll stop short of saying personality. there are definitely different behaviors. And, you know, we can look at different breeds, and some are very flighty, some are you know, much more docile. And even within that, there can be some differences. So I do think they really grow on you and can be pretty interesting.
So if you were a wannabe chicken keeper and you wanted a friendly, charismatic chicken, what kind would you buy?
I personally like brown leghorns. That's probably my favorite breed. They're not the calmest generally. So that kind of goes against that. Generally, the heavier breeds will be calmer, more docile. A lot of people like the silkies, which I don't know if you're familiar with silkies,
mm-mm,
but they carry a gene so that their feathers don't form like normal feathers. And so instead of having a feather where each little piece of feather is hooked on the next one, they just look like hair. And so they're really fuzzy.
Fluffy.
They can't fly because their wings are just kind of like fuzz covered. And so a lot of people really like those if you want a real calm bird.
And a fluffy one.
A fluffy one, that's right.
Doubles as duster.
Yeah.
So one thing that we hear about chickens, the phrase pecking order, and I imagine that comes from people who have observed chickens together. Does the chicken keeper need to step in once in a while, break things up, and keep the chickens in line?
Sure. And that is definitely a situation. That pecking order is real. And I always tell people chickens are really pretty mean to each other in general. But usually if you start the birds together and keep them together, it's not a big problem. The most problems come in if you decide I'm going to add some more chickens to my flock later. Then you have to watch that pretty closely. And sometimes you do have to step in, separate them for a few days and try again, and you can usually make it work eventually.
In terms of challenges that maybe a novice chicken keeper might come across, what do they need to know about what it's like and the challenges they might face raising chickens in the city?
I would say the biggest challenge that I get from most people is predators. And, you know, I was joking before we started here that a lot of things like a chicken dinner. And That's really true. In town, you've got raccoons,
foxes.
You've got foxes, especially are moving in. A lot of dogs, even cats when the birds are little can be a problem. Hawks sometimes. So you do have to really build your coop to keep stuff out. And that's probably the biggest issue I get.
We're talking urban chickens right now as we speak with University of Wisconsin Extension poultry specialist Ron Kane about the trend in urban poultry keeping. Last week, Wisconsin Rapids became the latest city in the state to allow coops within city limits.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you keep a coop in one of Wisconsin's cities that allows urban chickens? What's your experience been like? Why do you do it? What are the challenges you've run into along the way? And do you have any advice or maybe some questions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back with University of Wisconsin Extension poultry specialist Ron Kane about the trend of urban chicken keeping. Last week, Wisconsin Rapids became the latest city in the state to allow coops within city limits.
And you can join the conversation. Are you one of these chicken keepers within city limits? Call in and tell us about your experience. Do you have any advice for prospective urban chicken raisers, farmers? What do you call yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our phone lines now. Take our first call with Andrew in Mount Horeb. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I'd just like to say half the fun was building the chicken coop. We have a little beautiful little coop in Mount Horeb right in town. And since we built it, we don't watch television. We put our lawn chairs in the back, and we watch the chickens, and we look at the coop, and we look at people almost have accidents when they're driving by looking at it. But we also have three cats and three dogs, and since we got the chicks in the mail, we exposed the, and they all get along, cats and dogs, we exposed them from an early age, and they seem to respect the boundaries of the chickens and don't bother them when we leave them unattended. So,
all right. So
we're happy to watch them, and we're looking forward to our first eggs. And it's just it's a great experience just having them.
I got to ask you, Andrew, what does your coop look like?
I'm not sure if you're familiar with a monitor-style shed. It's a half monitor, so it kind of looks like a horse stable up on stilts.
Okay, well, Ron is nodding here. He knows what you're talking about.
Sure.
All right, well, sounds like something that's stopping traffic in Mount Horeb. No TV, all you need is chickens and a coop. Is that typical? Do people really get fascinated by their chickens?
They do. I would say that is very typical, that once you get them, and I hear a lot of times one spouse will get them and the other one, oh, I don't want chickens, and then they come around, and sometimes it goes the opposite way, so yeah.
And he said he's trained the cats and the dog to leave the chickens alone. Can you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. That's, you know, generally you have to watch at first, and most of them will get used to it. And adult chickens, the cats won't usually bother. The dogs, you know, you have to kind of watch. But
chickens can run pretty fast.
They can, yeah.
Within reason.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Andrew. And we're going to go next to David in Galesville. Hi, David.
Hey. Yeah, I had a question for the guest. I know elsewhere in the country, there's some businesses that you can rent a coop, and you, from my understanding, you get a couple hen-laying chickens for a couple months, and you just pay a renting fee, and then when you don't want them, you can give them back. And I was wondering if there's anything like that around the area that I could take advantage of.
Okay, interesting. A no-hassle way to start and maybe finish. What about that?
You know, I've heard of those also, and I don't know of any locally. I'm always a little, I think it would possibly work here, especially with winter, you know, because people wouldn't want to deal with them. I'm not quite sure how the people who run this, whether they mingle those chickens back together when they get them back or how that works. I think that would be, you know, in my mind, a disease issue and also a lot of fighting between the birds. So I don't know, but I've not heard of any in this local area.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, David, and appreciate your call. We're going to go next to Lynn in La Crosse. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. I just I have owned hens, no roosters, for the last 8 years. My hens are 6, 7, and 8 years old. Introducing new chickens to one another is a huge, huge issue. They do fight, and there is a pecking order, and they will kill each other. I clean my coop every day, so I guess, and they're very noisy when they're laying eggs. I just want to just talk about the downside. One, cleanliness. Do you want eggs that have been pooped on? No. Do you want a clean coop? Yes. Wintering them over, they do need water. You have to be able to get electricity out there to keep their water dish filled with water. There are a lot of work. If you plan to take on chickens and you're going to kill them, slaughter them in 6 months for their meat, it's still a lot of money. You're feeding them, you're taking care of them. I am really opposed. I originally liked the idea, but now after being a chicken owner, I'm really opposed to people getting chickens and not realizing what they're getting into. They're birds, they're animals, they can live for a long time, and they need to be taken care of.
Okay.
And I don't think people are thinking about that.
Great. Thank you, Lynn. And some, you know, some a splash of reality there about the Rosy Glow of chickens, some hard work that goes into it. What do you think about some of Lynn's thoughts there?
Well, I mean, I think that's very true. It's a pet, you know, or if you think about getting a dog, it's a similar situation. And so I do think that there can be some concerns. I would say that probably not everyone cleans the coop daily. I think that, you know, it depends on your system and your situation, but certainly I think some can do that. The fact that they live a long time, that is very true. And I think that is something that people who are looking for eggs, because egg production tends to decrease after the first couple of years. And so I usually tell people at some point you have to decide whether they're egg producers or whether they're pets, and you may, you know, plan accordingly from that. But yeah, you're right. There are some issues. But again, I think with any animal and any pet, you're going to have some of these things.
How long do chickens live?
I would say an average is probably 5 to 6 years. As she mentioned, you know, some can live to 10 or more. So they certainly can live quite a while.
Are there any towns that you know of that do allow roosters?
I don't know of any that expressly allow it. I think in some situations, it's not clear, because chickens have been allowed for a long time. And so I think in those situations, they probably don't expressly have roosters excluded. I think it would be a noise issue similar to a barking dog, where they could still bring in noise ordinances if they wanted to.
So maybe if you want to add a rooster, you want to talk to your neighbors.
Yeah, I definitely would.
Check your ordinance. All right. Well, thank you, Lynn. Appreciate your perspective there. And on to Zach in Superior. Hi, Zach.
Hi. Yeah, I have been raising for a while now Jersey Giants. And I don't know if you're familiar with the breed or not. They're becoming more popular now, especially up in Superior, because they're cold resilient, like extremely cold resilient once they get filled out. But the nice thing is they can't fly very high, usually, unless they get startled, then they'll fly a little higher. But you put up a fairly decent-sized fence, and usually they're too lazy to fly over it. The other thing is they're generally a pretty good chicken. They like to be petted. You can actually stick them in your lap, and they'll let you pet them and, you know, do all kinds of crazy things that most chickens I found don't let you do.
And Zach, real quick, what do they look like?
They're generally black. There is a rare breed that actually is a bluish, kind of a bluish gray color. And real quick, as far as cleanliness, all you got to do is put up aside this vinyl, that plastic vinyl stuff that you get, you know, for siding, the smooth stuff and sheets. Put that in your coop, and all you got to do is when they go outside, you spray it down with a hose, and that cleans it up really nice.
All right, a tip there about vinyl siding and Jersey Giants. Any thoughts, Ron?
Yeah, Jersey Giants are pretty interesting. They are large. I would guess you're not getting a lot of eggs from them. They're not known for great egg production, but yeah, certainly. And as you mentioned, black and blue, so interesting colors there.
And, Ron, what should our listeners consider when they're deciding whether or not they want to have their own backyard chickens?
Well, you know, I think certainly you have to consider that there are some things with cleanliness and dealing with winter. It's not like you can just stick them out there and ignore them, which, you know, hopefully if you're getting animals, you're not planning on that. There will be some cleaning. You know, I wouldn't go into it to expect to save money on eggs. I think it's going to cost quite a bit more than you can buy eggs for. But, you know, I think going into it with that end game of what I'm going to do with the birds, how much cleaning, things like that.
Ron, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure.
We've been talking to Ron Kane, University of Wisconsin Extension poultry specialist, about urban chickens. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear the tall tale of Clifford Thompson, the tallest Wisconsinite who ever lived. That's in today's edition of Wisconsin Legends.
First, more than 750 hospitals around the nation could be facing penalties as the federal government cracks down on patient injuries and infections. That's based on recently released data from the government and analyzed for Kaiser Health News.
65 hospitals made the list in Wisconsin, though many will probably avoid penalty, according to the latest report from the Wisconsin Hospital Association.
Joining us now to talk about the possible infractions and how we got here is Jordan Rao, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Jordan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So more than 750 hospitals across the nation are facing possible penalties due to patient injuries and infections. This is part of the Affordable Care Act. Can you give us a sense of what kinds of problems this is trying to address?
Well, infections are a major problem in hospitals around the country. Even though rates have been dropping, they're still very high. And we're seeing new crops of infections and bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. So it's a growing problem, as well as you have problems such as slips and falls and blood clots and bed sores, basically things where patients come into the hospital and they end up leaving worse than they were when they came in.
And what kinds of penalties are we talking about?
The government is going to, of all the hospitals that it assesses, it's going to take the quarter hospitals that are worse, and it's going to reduce their payments through Medicare by 1% over the course of a year starting in October. So every time a Medicare patient comes in for, say, a knee replacement, the hospital is only going to get 99% of payment for that. So it's, while it's not going to knock hospitals out of business, that certainly is a ding on the bottom line that's intended to really focus the attention not just of doctors and nurses, but also the hospital leaderships, board of trustees, investors, whoever, on the importance of cutting down on complications and infections.
Now, as I understand it, these are preliminary results. Does this mean that some of the hospitals that showed up on this list could still kind of clean up their act and escape penalty?
Yeah, the preliminary numbers are based on two-thirds of the total data that will be used. There's one more year of infection data that the government needs to factor in. So it's still pretty fluid. Now, if you're the way that they do it is they give every hospital a score from 1 to 10. If you're really, really high on there, 9 or 10, it's going to be very unlikely that those hospitals are going to avoid being penalized. And likewise, if your score is very, very low, say, below a 5, it's quite likely that you're going to stay that way because, for the most part, infections don't change that much over time rates. However, in a lot of these cases, you're actually dealing with fairly small numbers of infections and complications, so one or two could knock a hospital over the line one way or the other.
Yeah, how are hospitals being measured on this?
They're being measured on there are two major types of infections that they're being measured on. One are called CLABSIs, and these are infections from central lines or catheters that are put into veins. And hospitals use these regularly to pump in saline or chemotherapy or antibiotics into patients. And often these become sort of freeways of infections because bacteria will get in and go straight into the bloodstream. So that's one. The second one is called a CAUTI, and it's a catheter-associated urinary tract infection. And these are catheters that are directed into the bladder, and they remove urine. And so that's, obviously important when patients aren't able to get up and go to the bathroom. So those are the two major things that the government is looking at. But they're also looking at, as I mentioned, a bunch of other adverse events, like slips and falls and lacerations during surgery.
Now, it sounds like some of the major teaching hospitals may be more vulnerable because, I guess, of the large amount of things that they go there and maybe conflicting priorities. Can you give a sense of what the teaching hospitals are up against?
One of the surprising results of the of our look at the preliminary penalties was the huge proportion of teaching hospitals that received them, 54% nationwide. And again, this is, you know, overall, it's just a quarter of hospitals that would get them, but 54% are teaching hospitals. And so that's raised a lot of questions. On the one hand, is it possible that there's something wrong with these measures, that they're not taking into account the relative sickness of patients, or the fact that these hospitals just tend to do more things where patients need catheters, for instance? Or on the other hand, is there something fundamentally flawed about teaching hospitals, that they don't place as much attention on patient safety, that they're distracted, that, you know, in the midst of, you know, having residents round and dealing with a lot of very, very complex research, that they're sort of neglecting the most simple things? And these are very, very hotly debated and I think unresolved questions.
UW Health here in Madison, Wisconsin, is on that preliminary list as an example of one of these big teaching hospitals. We also have a number of smaller hospitals, rural hospitals. How is it going to affect them?
Well, the most rural hospitals, the ones that are designated as critical access hospitals by the government, are exempted from this program, so they won't be affected at all in this year. In the future, they might be factored in, but right now they're left out. But there are community hospitals. There's a total of 65 hospitals in Wisconsin that are eligible for the penalties. And of those, about 35% were designated as having the preliminary penalties. And that's a very high proportion compared to other states. And whether that is something particular to Wisconsin hospitals, or if it's just sort of the luck of the draw with running these numbers and it's sort of statistical noise, isn't clear.
Is there any danger that some hospitals could try to underreport their numbers of infections or other instances of hospital harm to escape notice and avoid penalties?
That's a great question, and it's always possible. There has been some concern that some states that mandate reporting of infections, that the infection rates are higher than others. But for some of this stuff, first of all, a third of it is based on Medicare billing records, so there's not as much leeway, and there are significant penalties if you underreport. And then the other information is surveillance infection rates as reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so, you know, to avoid the penalty, you're sort of engaging in a fairly significant government, you know, I hesitate to say conspiracy, but, you know, something that's unethical and potentially illegal. So I sort of wonder whether for that it's worth the risk for any hospital to really avoid reporting these.
Would you say that this is driven largely by concern about some of these antibiotic-resistant bacteria that are out there and costs, or is it something else?
It is part of, I mean, there's certainly a lot of it that's concerned with the antibiotic-resistant bacteria and for the amount of damage that is done to patients. I mean, 1 in 8 patients suffers a hospital-acquired condition, you know, something that was potentially avoidable. So that is a major concern. And then more broadly, it's about steering the gigantic ship of Medicare payment in a different way, because historically Medicare has paid just a flat fee for each hospital, no matter how your patient turns out. You know, I mean, they adjust it for what the patient is in there for and how sick they might be and such like that. But you get the, you know, it's sort of like lawyers. You know, you just get, you know, you do a great job, you win the case, you lose the case, you get paid the same way. And so that's something that everyone is, or not everyone, but a lot of policy people are unhappy with. And so this is part of a broader move to say, you know what, we're going to start paying our hospitals and then eventually our doctors and nursing homes and all our healthcare providers. We're going to take into account what good a job they do when we're paying them, and maybe that'll incentivize them to pay a lot more attention to quality and a bit less to the bottom line.
And so far, patient advocacy groups, they're happy with this. But what about the hospitals and medical community in general? What are they saying, especially some of these institutions that have been red flagged for now?
I would say they're going through the Kubler-Ross 7 stages of grief and denial. You know, there's some that see this coming. I mean, it's been in law since 2010 and are just sort of resigned to it. There are some that feel that have been way ahead of the curve anyway when to curb infections and conditions, which obviously expose them to malpractice and to fines, as well as to having to pay, you know, costs to take care of the problems. And then there are others that are really, really unhappy, that feel that the program is unfair because even if your rates are lower, going down, you can still be penalized. You're just being compared to everybody else. That the for all the stuff that you and I have been talking about, that it may not be a level playing field. And so they're, you know, just angry and displeased.
Now, there are some reports that, in general, rates of infection are falling. So why do we need this now?
Well, some of it was, I mean, the latest reports have had that for some these types of accidents, they are going down. Surgical site infections, for instance, were down 20% over a four-year period. But in others, they're pretty flat. In terms of the urinary tract infections, they've actually crept up a little bit. And as we've mentioned, there's not just infections that are antibiotic resistant like MRSA and C. diff that are coming, but an even worse strain that there's no known cure or treatment for that are becoming of increased worry. So even though they may be dropping, they're still not at the bottom. And then the other thing is that for a lot of this stuff, the view is that they really are preventable, that if you do, if you follow pretty clear protocols about how to handle a catheter and sterilization and when to remove it, which is earlier rather than later, you should be able to avoid most of these things.
Jordan, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Jordan Rau, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News.
Garrison Keillor always says us folks in the Midwest are hardy and above average. Today we take a look at a man who really took that to a whole different level.
Clifford Thompson was one of the tallest men who ever lived and was most certainly the tallest man ever to call Wisconsin home. During his lifetime, he had many careers, from a circus performer to a practicing lawyer and plenty of other ventures in between. Today on Wisconsin Legends, we learn more about the big man and his connection to the state.
Here to help us do that is Ashley Steinbrink. She's a writer and graphic designer at Who Knew, an arts and culture website covering Northeast Wisconsin. She recently wrote a piece that took a closer look at the life of Clifford Thompson. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
All right. Well, let's start with the basics here. Just how tall was Clifford Thompson?
Well, there's been a little bit of controversy on the subject of his actual height, but he claimed he was 8'7", 8 feet 7 inches.
Wow.
Pretty tall. I thought 6 feet was tall. So, but the other people say, you know, he was 7'5". There was a researcher named Craig Elbert who more recently used photo analysis to determine his size was somewhere between 8'3" and 8'6". But, you know, that's common, I guess, among giants to exaggerate their size a bit, maybe wear taller shoes and a taller hat, and, you know, circuses, which he spent a lot of his life. They specialize in illusions. So who knows? But I kind of go toward the photo analysis one, somewhere between 8'3 and 8'6", but he probably knew best.
And he said that there wasn't anything in particular medically going on with him. He didn't have any sort of hormonal or glandular issue. He was just... You descended from Vikings, pretty much.
Yeah, he had that Norwegian blood, and yep, he wanted people to know it was nothing to do with any kind of condition or health issue. He was 12 pounds when he was born. His family, his mom and dad, were normal height. His dad was 5'10", his mom was 5'9". He had two younger sisters who were average height. He didn't stop growing until he was 27. So,
just kept growing.
He just kept growing.
He was born, I understand, in North Dakota, but spent a lot of his life in Wisconsin. Can you tell us some about his early days here in the state?
Sure, yeah. He moved, his family actually owned a dairy farm in Scandinavia, Wisconsin, which is sort of near Iowa. And, you know, it was 7 years old, I believe, when he came from North Dakota. So he had a pretty normal childhood, I guess. He went to school, and he tried out for the basketball team, but he actually didn't make it. I think it was because of they were worried about injuries and stuff. Mm-hmm. But you would think he'd be really good on the basketball team. I don't know. He lived a pretty normal childhood. Then he kind of got into the circus. He did that for 12 years. After he graduated, he wanted to be a teacher. He wanted to teach high school math and science. But he actually struggled to get a job in that profession. I guess he just assumed that the superintendents who rejected him were nervous that he would frighten the children. So
Yeah, this is a guy who had he had a lot of different lives as he went along. It seemed as though he started, you know, with one thing, the circus, and wanted to be a teacher. And, you know, maybe inevitably he ended up in Hollywood.
Yeah, you know, he kind of got a little bit frustrated with the whole teacher thing. He spent a year applying for different positions there. And that's sort of when he decided to do the circus thing. To become a professional giant, and that worked out for him for 12 years doing that. And one of the circuses, it was the Barnes Circus, their headquarters was in Los Angeles, so that's kind of how he came into the movie scene, the Hollywood films. He was, you know, known to be the largest man in any, appearing in any movies, the tallest man to ever appear in Hollywood movies, I think is what the Chicago Tribune said. So, in 1931, there was an article on that. So, yeah, he was in several movies. He was in A Day in the Life of a Giant. I don't know that anyone's going to be really familiar with some of these 1930 movies, but Movie Town, Sealskins was one of the more popular ones, and The 20th Century. So,
and I got to say, it's not really enough to talk about him. You have to see him in a way to believe him, and we've got a video that we'll be posting on the Central Time Facebook page. He really is remarkable. He looks huge. He doesn't look like a normal human being.
Yeah, no, I mean, his shoe size was 22. Can you imagine having that large of a shoe? Everything had to be custom made. The only thing that he didn't have to have custom made was his necktie. Otherwise, his hat, his shirts, pants, everything. His chest was 46 inches across. On his ring finger, you could fit a half dollar right through it. So imagine having a finger, your ring finger, as big as a 50-cent piece and, you know, He had to have a 19-inch extension added to the steering wheel on his car. He drove a 1935 Ford sedan, and he actually had to have those front seats removed, and he sat in the back seat with that 19-inch extension to be able to reach the steering wheel. So that attracted about as much attention as he did.
And I imagine a lot of the attention he got was maybe unfriendly or at least joking about his height. In researching this story, did you get a sense of how he dealt with that, how he felt about that?
You know, I think he had a pretty good attitude most of the time about his height. I know that he got a little bit annoyed by some comments that he heard often, like, how's the weather up there? He got frustrated by people that would ask him stuff like that. And he was really just, his biggest fear was getting his head chopped off by one of those four-bladed ceiling fans. So living a life like a giant, you know, I mean, it's not normal, that's for sure, but he had a good attitude about it.
And he was a really handsome guy, so handsome, in fact, that he ended up being a spokesman for Blatt's Beer.
For what? What
for a beer company, right?
Yes, actually. After he just felt like he wanted to do something else with his life, so he just kind of quit the circus. They weren't that happy with him, the employers, when he quit. That was when he was in the Cole Brothers Circus. But he just felt like he needed to do something that required more skills, so he tried to be a spokesperson in Milwaukee, and he did some car commercials for Ford. I think it was something like the Ford V8 is roomy enough for a giant. And he also was a spokesperson for the Big Shoe Store in Stevens Point. But during that time, the Wisconsin milk industry actually hired him to walk around at the Wisconsin State Fair. And he was wearing a sign that said, "Drink milk, look what it did for me," you know. And that's when Blatt's Brewery, which is actually Pabst Brewery in Milwaukee now, it later became Pabst, but that's when they saw him and just kind of joked around him that he should be wearing a sign for beer instead of milk. And he kind of took it seriously. It was that same night of the Wisconsin State Fair that he went to the offices of the brewery and talked with them about being the spokesperson there. And that's how he ended up landing that job. And he did that for several years. I think it was 4 years he was a salesman for that company.
All that, and he did a stint as a lawyer, too. He got his law degree.
That's right. Well, after all this travel, and things started to get rough for him after a little while because, you know, at this point he was 460 pounds. He was walking with a cane because that was a lot easier. All the travel kind of got to him a little bit. They were traveling 40,000 miles every year, him and his wife. And this was his second wife now. His first wife, I guess, divorced him because, well, she said it was because she was sick of making his large meals, extra large meals. But
we'll leave it there for now. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us and sharing his story with us today.
Yeah, no problem at all.
That's Ashley Steinbrink. She's a writer and graphic designer at Who Knew? That's an arts and culture website covering Northeast Wisconsin.